previously on Something Who.
Welcome to the podcast where we take something old, a Doctor Who story from the original series, compare it with something new, one from the new series, and add something borrowed to make Something Who. Hello, I'm Richard, and we're back with Something Who podcast, where this time we're looking at two stories which pose the question of what it means to be a Dalek. We'll look at second Doctor story, Evil of the Daleks, from season 4, and after that we'll examine 10th Doctor outing, Daleks in Manhattan and Evolution of the Daleks, from series 3. And I've got a great lineup with me to decide whether these stories open the Daleks' casings to reveal a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, or just an empty void. Starting with science and astronomy writer and Something Who's own Dr. Science, Giles.
Hello.
We liked him so much last time, so he's back again. So it's our very own Fraser Hines. Here's Rick.
Hey. Well, good evening, everybody. I appear to be stuck in the Something Who bunker.
So
Help.
For anyone who missed our last pair of episodes, Rick posts on social media as Brick Pandorica and makes fantastic Lego models of Doctor Who scenes. And finally, and this has been a long time in the making, our guest on this episode is the extraordinary, exuberant jazz pianist, convention enlivener, and sometime BFI attendee. It's Jess Jerkovic. Yeah, it's nice to have something of an international flavour. We have been accused occasionally of being four posh Guardian readers who sort of talk over earnestly about Doctor Who. So anyway, I mean, we've got somebody who doesn't sound posh anyway. That's good. So, moving on then to Daleks in Manhattan and Evolution of the Daleks, written by Helen Rayner and directed by James Strong. What I usually say about the new series is I watched it on original broadcast and I haven't seen it since. This is going to be kind of similar to that, but I saw the first episode, the Daleks in Manhattan, going out live at my sister-in-law's house. So it's one of those rare occasions when I actually watch Doctor Who with other people. I mean, the tragedy of my life is that normally I'm squirreled away on my own because nobody that I share my life with is that enthusiastic about it. But on this occasion, the whole family was watching, which was a slightly weird experience. And I must have felt like I missed out on something because I then watched it later in the week again on my own, before the second episode came up. So yeah, I watched this. I had previously watched the first episode twice and the second one only once. And at the time, I think I thought the first episode was a strong one, and I wasn't so sure about the second. But I may have changed my mind on that on second viewing. But anyway, I'll let you maybe talk about how you came across this one, or yeah, your relationship with it, perhaps.
This one I would have seen not quite contemporarily because I didn't have a way to watch it. At that time, and it wasn't right. Immediately broadcast in the States. I don't remember exactly how we got it and when, what the delay was. But I did have a friend of mine who probably used some downloading ability to rip it off the internet or something. And then he gave me a copy. So I would have seen it. But yeah, probably only once or twice would I've seen both of these. And to the extent, I am embarrassed to say that when I went looking for this episode, I misremembered what Doctor was in it. Mm-hmm. So please don't be mad. I'm a real fan and true fan. But that had slipped my mind. I apologize about that. But now it is fresh. It's back in my mind again.
Fab.
So for me, it was a family watch. Mm-hmm. By that time, we sat around and watched it. I've seen it a few times. As I said in the last episode, this is probably more in my mind than Evil of the Daleks, really, in terms of my remembering the plot, key scenes, who was in it. And I remember at the time feeling pretty positive about the story, and we'll see how that holds up over the next
Yeah.
Hour.
Yeah, I would have watched it on transmission. I'm not sure what in what configuration of company, if any, at the time. But yeah, must have watched it a couple of times since at least, because series three is a bit of a fave of mine amongst New Who. Although I always felt like this was, I don't know, I always felt like it was somewhat a weak link, but not really deserving of some of the criticism that it got. But yeah, it feels like it's been a long time since but it also felt like it didn't quite fit in thematically. It always feels to me like series three is thematically so tight, a lot of it, that everything slots together and everything is sort of building towards where it goes. And this felt like, okay, oh yes, and then there's the two-part Dalek story that goes off and does its own, that's doing its own thing as a bit of a bridge between the end of series two and stuff like that, and is sort of more concerned with its own. But yeah, definitely I think I enjoyed it tonight, and you know, I warmed to it more. I think I appreciate it in the spirit that was intended a bit more.
So I suppose as an opening gambit, I'll say that I think setting the action in a theatre always seems to work pretty well for Doctor Who. There's that kind of mixture of both of creepiness of the backstage and the scenery store and whatever, and also the kind of lush visuals that you can get as well.
Yes. Up until the title sequence, wow, it's a blast of colour, of sounds, of activity. Wonderful. They even throw in a creepy clown in one of the backstage corridors, and then bam, this pig-like human creature charges at you. Cue theme music. Really arresting start to an episode, and brilliant. I'm in for the duration.
I have a quirk about more than one about me and Doctor Who is that I have always resisted anything American in Doctor Who. I actually dislike it. At least historically. I'm more grown now, mostly. But that is always something that kind of has stuck in my craw a little bit, to use an Americanism. I like my Doctor Who British. It's the Britishness that I love as a foreigner. And so sometimes I have to kind of get over myself to eventually enjoy American characters, American places. And so that's something that I have to monitor. But it's also in my adopted home city. And so it's certainly charming in that way. And I think it does a very credible job of representing the city, representing the building of the Empire State Building, and representing Central Park, which is certainly its own environment and atmosphere. And they did well to place actual buildings in the background, not just the Empire State Building, but buildings along Central Park. Along Central Park West, and I think it was that angle that they used towards Central Park West. It was clever, and certainly the period works very well. You know, not just theaters, but period theaters are so evocative and represent that period so effectively, those periods so effectively, I think. Even with a small scale.
It's interesting. One thing I had to remind myself of thinking about when this was is that all the Hoovervillain, and you know, all of this stuff, you know, this was made in 2007 when the world was riding high, and the idea that there was going to be another sort of big crash just coming around the corner was, because it all feels like you watch it now and you think, oh, it's laden with social commentary and obviously things they were getting at, and it was probably wasn't at all in their minds, you know, some of this stuff at the time. The past 10 or 15 years and what stuff that's happened since the,
It's certainly, Giles, a theme that I want to talk about over the next hour, really, which is it is a lot different to watch in 2024 than it was in 2007. And perhaps that means that some of the fun elements of this story are well and truly overshadowed by the grim elements and some of the foretelling that that takes place in this story. And you know, it's set in the Great Depression. Let's start from that point of view. It's right that there is a heavy shadow over this episode anyway, in 2007 lenses, but in 2024 there are other elements of this story that tragically I think are reflective of our contemporary world and what we see on the news. And it doesn't mean that I like the episode less. In fact, it's probably going up in my estimation as a result of this, but it's not an episode played for laughs.
No, it has its moments. The saucy Tallulah character is a bit more for laughs, but you're quite right. It's grim and there's a serious body count.
Should we stick to the frost for a moment
before
before we descend into grimness? Tallulah as a character does her absolute best to shine light into the episode. And I was a devout Spooks watcher at that time, and I did not click through that first episode. That Randa Raisin was Tallulah, I think, because the contrast between her and Joe in Spooks was so huge, and I was so taken by the opening of that episode that I was bought into the scene, the setting, the characters almost immediately. But as I say, against a backdrop where you're the only light really in that episode, I think that character and the actor do a brilliant job.
Yes, you know, she's fantastic. Loved her in Spooks, loved her in this, and I was lucky enough to see her do Anne Boleyn on stage. She did Brenton did a Anne Boleyn play with her, at the Globe back more years ago than I care to remember now, but she was fantastic in that.
And now making a big contribution in The Big Finish world as well.
Yes, of course.
Oh, okay.
Well, strangely enough, I'm just listening to an audio book that she happens to have read. That wasn't the reason why, but a book about a history book on the English Civil War. But it's very good.
So as our reporter on the scene, Jess, was concepts like Hooverville things that you were familiar with, or actually this was a case of Doctor Who being educational?
I was in fact educated. I didn't know anything about Hooverville. I certainly knew obviously about the Great Depression. I knew roughly about the time when the Empire State Building was built, but that was about it. And so that particular instance is really fascinating. It's also fascinating in the present day to realize how a certain recent former president is being equated with Hoover. But that's another topic. But I was really engaged with it because it felt like it was opening my eyes to not only the fact that it existed at all, but the portrayed equality in that community. I'm reminded of another random Doctor Who line, allies in adversity. They have to come together to survive, and all potential, differences fall away just so that they can try to get through this and try to survive and exist and find a way to get work and put a meal on the table, or even if it's just a loaf of bread. So that was really interesting to me, especially as a, quote, local. I've only lived here for 25 years, so I don't know if I'm a New Yorker yet. But yeah, found that fascinating.
I also liked the fact that Martha and the Doctor enter New York by the Statue of Liberty, because the general tale of immigration into the United States is you go to Ellis Island through the vision of the Statue of Liberty above you. Yes. And there are probably other echoes to how the Doctor approached New York in previous episodes. But I thought that was a nice nod to history as the Doctor and Martha established themselves in New York in the 1930s.
It is a bit of a distance, though, because they had to find their way from Liberty Island to Manhattan itself and then travel up to Central Park. They are not proximitous to each other. But never mind that. It was a nice, quiet place to park the TARDIS, I feel sure.
Mm. Oh, well, it's like watching any representations of London on film. And you go, indeed, any place that you know. You just think there's so many shortcuts get taken.
No grudges held there on my part.
No.
There's a nice use of the Gershwin tune to sort of introduce them, I suppose, to the Statue of Liberty. And then I guess, you know, that kicks off a bunch of contemporary tracks, Jess.
It is an interesting touch. And again, a link back to Evil, that in the opening episode, there is diegetic music that is heard by the characters, not just incidental. Although that's only in the case of Happy Days Are Here Again.
Right.
And that is played underneath the opening scene in the back of the theater. Although it's not clear that it's heard by the characters, even at that point, but it's also played eventually through the radio by the Doctor in, I guess, I think that's Evolution by that point.
Mm-hmm.
It is very curious, I find, that they seem to have cut and pasted an actual Rhapsody in Blue recording rather than a Murray Gold homage.
Right, yes.
It's specifically Rhapsody in Blue rather than a Murray Gold, you know, pastiche of it, which I'm sure he would have been very happy to do and very capable of. So that's kind of a surprising choice. But also, the two pieces, Happy Days Are Here Again, and then there's a very brief Putting on the Ritz when they are walking into through the park towards Hooverville. And what I admired in looking up the recordings they used, they were produced in 1930. So, well Fantastic. Done. It's absolutely authentic and totally period of the time. I mean, that song that Tallulah sings is a Murray Gold creation, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, gets the period across. But I was impressed that they were able to set it in such a accurate way, soundtrack wise, and those touches that they were able to add that verisimilitude of the location. It was clever. Well done there.
We get Hugh Quarshie, you know, dispensing the wisdom of Solomon in it's very much like the Bible story, you know, to divide the thing in two.
Yeah, that's pretty direct when he's named Solomon.
Indeed.
Solomon is a character that appeals to me a lot. Obviously, I think he's the contrast character to Diagoras in the sense that he has the courage, the compassion, the hope, and it's the opposite of what the Daleks are looking for from their human factor in this episode, which makes it his death quite surprising as a morale tale. He would be the kind of character that in more joyful, hopeful, uplifting Doctor Who stories would as a consequence survive. And I think it's something to the undertone of grimness within this story that his fate at the point in which he is appealing for all that's best of humanity in the Daleks is repaid by him just being cut down in Hooverville by the Daleks. And as I say, while he's around in the episode, he really drives the best of the episode for me.
I wonder if that's okay, though. I mean, in the sense that, you know, he remains entirely true to himself through the story. So, in human terms, you'd say the fact that he dies and some of the other characters live is a tragedy. But at the same time, he doesn't compromise his values or beliefs in attempting to deal with the Daleks.
No, I agree. I think it's consistent with the tone of the story. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Had they suddenly created a raft of happy endings for characters who we're being asked to empathise with, it would have undercut, really, I think, the tone that's being set here.
There's something in Russell T. Davies's mind, I imagine, that's to do with pigs. I mean animals in general, but you know with rhinos and cats and so on. But we got a pig in Aliens of London, didn't
yes,
we?
Yeah.
And we get pigs here again. And I wonder at that. I mean, you could just have had Robo-Men or something like that. You know, something we've seen before.
Well, we get Robo-Men in, arguably Robo-Men in episode 2, I guess. Maybe not quite.
Yes. Yeah.
They might as well be. Yes, I mean, I suppose they could have put, and obviously, yeah, we mustn't forget the Salem Rain arriving. They could have put, I guess they could have had Ogrons instead.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't have had the conversion issue is a...
Yeah, it's more about the conversion,
and
guess,
the treatment but... of, yeah, people as fodder. In that, and yeah, I guess, yeah, thematically, yeah, the harsh times, yeah.
But, you know, the animal/human hybrid is so much in danger of seeming lazy because it's a long time science fiction trope.
Mm. Yeah.
Is the grafting of, you know, it's the pig man, it's the animal man, it's the something, you know. The human mixed with this, you know, and
the fly,
It comes off a little B movie, and that's sometimes a little disappointing to me when it's so immediately apparent like that it's simply a beautiful makeup. I mean, I think it's flawless, but it's sort of disappointing that you can reduce it so directly that way. It's kind of.
The thing is, I think, you know, I don't entirely agree with the idea that this is humorless. In some ways, I think it's a comedy. It's a very black comedy in places, but it's definitely got an eye on pastiching universal horror kind of stuff. And so, Dr. Moreau and that sort of thing. I think that was sort of cited as being a definite influence, and that, you know, that's got lots of human animal hybrid stuff going on.
I see what you mean
there. And there's a bit of Phantom of the Opera going on as well with Lazo and Tallulah. And okay, we don't quite get King Kong but we get the Empire State Building in there. Yeah. So I think that I think that sort of stuff is
I'm willing to forgive in this instance. I think anthropomorphism could be a dangerous game in terms of what people read into it.
Mm.
We talked about the pig pilot in Aliens of London. Mm. That for me was played absolutely as a joke by the Slovene. It was very pigs in space.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whereas here, I think you need visually something which allows you to see Laszlo halfway between the two. So Ogrons wouldn't have worked. I don't think halfway to a Robo-Man visually particularly works. But they want absolutely a fast ticket to the Daleks having debased a human being. And all those stereotypical characteristics that we place on pigs in terms of being, you know, the lowest of the low.
And unclean.
Absolutely. Frankly, again, we're back to the world of stupid again. And, you know, it does that straight from the off in that first scene before the title sequence. Visually, you're in that something is going wrong here. Somebody is messing with human nature. And so, as I say, thinking too much about, you know, that half pig, half human portrayal. I think it is simply there to get us quickly to the point that something is being manipulated around human beings, and it does it well.
Fair enough. Although the key word you use there is quickly, and that is always something that the new series has to deal with. At least this is a two-parter, the equivalent of a classic four-parter. And so there's more room for this stuff to develop in a satisfactory way. I still find standalone 45-minute stories very difficult because they constantly have to do that kind of shortcutting.
Mm.
And they sometimes suffer from it. Not always. I don't say that, you know, oh, the old times were better. But it is a problem. It's a writing problem that is difficult for... Sometimes it is difficult in the format of Doctor Who, I think, to handle things like that smoothly in 45 minutes. Unless you're dealing with a 3 or 4 person cast.
Mm.
That's tricky.
Yeah. Equally, the 2 parts format, you know, the modern series can sometimes struggle with, because you often get cases where where there's not enough incident in the first half, especially in the first few years, because they're holding back the big reveal until the midway point, which, yes, there is a big reveal at the midway point here, but it feels like there's enough. Yeah, you know, so sometimes you know, as with the Cybermen, Rise of the Cybermen and Age of Steel, that always, to me, really feels hobbled by the fact it's holding back on the Cybermen until for the cliffhanger, and then has to cram all the next 3 episodes worth of plot into the second half. And this feels like it's nicely balanced. There's enough incidents and so on. And it did strike me that it's very similar, the setup. I mean, we touched on that a bit before. Yeah, the setup of Diagoras and Waterfield and the reveal of the Daleks in the same way. Again, it's spoiled by the fact we know it's something of the Daleks is the name of, you know, Daleks in Manhattan. But the idea that Daleks are getting involved in what seems like human business, human shenanigans for their own ends, and you get that sort of meeting between someone who's ostensibly a businessman, and it turns out they're in business with the Daleks, it seems.
Mm.
Yeah, but yeah, I think there's enough stuff there, and then it's not really until in later years they start to cheat the format a bit more with how they do the two-parters and things.
Yeah, I mean,
obviously where they'll effectively have 2 standalone stories or have a time jump or whatever.
I felt the story, the first part, is slightly odd in the respect that it could have had a really good reveal around it's the Daleks, because at the start it just looks like these pig creatures and an over-aggressive skyscraper builder.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a good story in itself, to be honest.
It is. Mm. Then the flip side is, and I guess some of this is hindsight, you expect Dalek Sek as the half-human to be revealed earlier in episode 1 than it is. And it almost feels like that is being dragged out by convenience to that halfway point. And it's also compounded by the fact that for the UK audience, the Radio Times... showed the half-human on the cover before episode 1 was shown.
Mm. Yeah.
But there's publicity for you.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah. Bit of an issue with it, especially when it's not the greatest design. And, you know, I don't know what's the headpiece. Yeah, you make allowances, but it's a bit hard to take seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. I mean, the Dalek is such a great design, and then a bloke in a suit with a, you know, something that looks a bit like a Dalek mutant on his head. Mm. It's all right, but it makes it very hard for that character to sort of show any kind of expression. You know, it's. I mean, I know a Dalek doesn't show expression either, but I know it just doesn't. It's difficult, I think.
Mm.
It ends up being about the vocal performance, typically. Yeah. Mm. If you've got a mask where you can't, you know, express anything visually with a twitch. Or, I mean, some animatronics are going on there, obviously, but I don't think it was ever expressing emotion in the movements. It was just to seem creepy and alive.
Yeah.
Fine, but it does create an acting problem, if not a dramatic one.
It's a shame, because visually there's lots to like in this episode, as we talked about the way that they've recreated 1930s New York, Hooverville, utterly convinced by that. By and large, I like the Art Deco feel of the interior of the Empire State Building. Love all the costumes in the theatre, all those things just completely sell the environment to me, and then I just wasn't as convinced as I should have been about the half-human Dalek.
Mm. So the bizarre, just getting back to the recreation in New York and so on, the bizarre fact I found out during our interval, which made me go, really? It's, at least according to Sharon Sullivan, who is most likely drawing on complete history and things like that, apparently the plate shots for New York, which they went over and took and used as a basis for things. I don't know how they'd have done it otherwise, but apparently it says here that while they were in pre-production, one of Strong's goals was to achieve a convincing realization of the city. Well, on August the 30th, he learned that Doctor Who Confidential was planning to fly Helen Rayner out to New York to do an interview segment on location, presumably to support the episode of Doctor Who Confidential that would be going right out about this story. And at that point, they didn't have any plans for actually shooting anything in New York.
Oh, right.
And so Strong then suggested to Phil Collinson that maybe a skeleton film crew could go along with them as well and film some actual material that could go, some plate shots and stuff that could go into the story.
That was inspired because it might have shown up the production actually see what New York looks like and depending on what the result would have been.
But it's very odd to think, okay, you know, Confidential had the budget to go and take Helen Rayner off to New York in the main show. The main show didn't.
I mean, that just sounds like the TV industry all over, really, doesn't it?
A good bit of juggling on Phil Collinson's part, I think.
Yeah.
One of the themes that I like each time I rewatch is, and the production sticks pretty rigidly to it, is the use of altitude as a symbol of power.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, at varying times, the sewers
that are
rampantly full of pigs and really the doctor and his companions at their least powerful, their weakest in the episode. Yeah. You've got the ground level, which isn't great either. Hooverville is on there full of people clinging to survival and existence and taking a dollar a day to do something they might not survive doing. And then you work your way up Dagoras's office, whatever floor the Cult of Skaro are occupying, and then ultimately you've got the lightning rod at the top of the incomplete Empire State Building, which is where the Doctor manages to get himself in order to turn the tables and start to save the day. And they stick, as I say, they stick really rigidly to that, and the Daleks, when they appear in Hooverville, appear above everybody else as well as a symbol of that power. And again, it's not writing that will change the literary or screenwriting world, but it was a way they wanted to portray the environment and the who holds the power in the story, and they really stick to it well, I think, during the two episodes.
It's interesting. When the Daleks are in Hooverville and they're flying around, you know, they're obviously, they're very powerful. The Daleks also, when they're in the sewers, there's at least a Dalek in the sewer at some point. I mean, what's very clear about that is the limitation of being a Dalek. You know, when you've got a hatch that's big enough for a human to get through, but not big enough for a Dalek to fly through. Even though it's, it can fly upstairs because there's space for it to do that, but it can't go through a manhole cover.
Oh, Rich, you're spoiling what I've just said then.
Well, no, I don't think so, because the Dalek is less powerful in the sewers than it is when it's out up in the air, right?
Yes.
Well, and that's where we get the little conspiracy thing, isn't it? Which is always another, gives me a chuckle at any rate.
Yeah.
Looking around, is anyone listening before?
I would dare say, iconic scene. I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
It gives an insight into their personalities, which they aren't supposed to have. But they're the Cult of Skaro, so they're a little bit separate from your grunt Dalek. But that's what makes it so interesting, is that looking around is my favorite part, absolutely.
Mm. So we should talk about the Cult of Skaro. Mm-hmm. I think we've got some similarities with Evil of the Daleks here in that they're created as these by the Dalek Emperor as these free thinkers. Mm-hmm. And that free thinking is to come up with creative ways to survive. They are named in the way that Alpha, Beta, yeah. and Omega are in Evil of the Daleks. And the Doctor really challenges Sek to quite literally come out of his shell. You know, that's your name. You know, you've got a mind of your own. The Doctor really trying to push that free thinking to a conclusion that is, you just don't want to be a Dalek anymore. That's fundamentally the problem here. Mm. Not that you don't know how to survive. It's that if you're going to survive, you need to be something better than what you are. So I'm not quite sure how the Cult of Skaro comes about in this world of purist Dalek DNA, but once they're revealed, you know, a few episodes earlier at the end of season two,
yeah,
I'm pleased that they came back to that theme and said, well, what is this that we've just landed into Doctor Who lore? What do we do with this Dalek unit now that we've let it out of the box? And this episode for me satisfactorily plays out, well, where does this free thinking get you?
It's interesting, as you were talking, Rick, I made a connection which I hadn't until you were speaking about the Cult of Skaro. The Cult of Skaro is, in a way, a Dalek representation of what has to happen in Destiny of the Daleks, where the Daleks have to go back to Davros to learn how to think more freely, in a way. You could put it that way. And so that's an interesting connection. And then I also remembered that a little, you know, nerdy sound thing I wanted to throw in was, one of the alarm noises in the laboratory is from Destiny of the Daleks.
What?
you might have to just believe me for the moment, but when the Doctor and the Mavalans and Tyson are running away from the Dalek control room, there's an alarm noise that goes off. Wow, wow, wow. And that's exactly the same noise that's used both there. And so it's only because you brought up the Cult of Skaro, and then I remembered the connection to Destiny, and I was like, oh, I'm sure that's just coincidence. Or is it? I don't know. But I found that kind of curious.
The intent here is that they're looking for a human factor that they can evolve into, or at least Dalek Sek is. It obviously becomes clear that the Cult of Skaro is not of a single mind on this subject. So what we start to see is, unlike the selection of Jamie in Evil of the Daleks, it is Diagoras with his ambition and his hatred and his aggression and his war. And that interesting discussion that takes place between Diagoras and Dalek Sek, where they reflect on the fact that they have both been in a great war, and that's how they label World War One, Time War. And there's a degree of empathy between the two. Interestingly, we also have running around in this story Solomon, who has been in that very same World War One situation, who realizes that humanity has to be better than what occurred in the Great War, and the Doctor, who has equally been at the other side of the Time War to the Daleks, and his reaction to, I need to do something better to the universe to get over the experiences that he had during the Time War. So there is this kind of natural bond, I think, between Diagoras and Dalek Sek that suggests, well, that's the version of humanity the Daleks want to buy into on this occasion.
And yet it backfires on them anyway, and he still ends up being more,
in the same way that the Emperor is looking in Evil of Daleks, is looking for the ultimate Dalek, the purest Dalek that is the exact opposite of the human factor. We have Dalek Khan in the Cult of Skaro in this story, saying any deviation from Dalekness is unacceptable.
Mm. Yeah,
and I'm gonna put a stop to this. And even if that means he disappears in a whatever his escape mechanism at the end of this episode is. As the only remaining Dalek. Temple shift, that's right. Even if 4 has been reduced to 1, that's worth it to retain that purity and, you know, that racial cleansing narrative that exists across many Dalek stories is never more evident here.
And it's certainly true that, sort of as you were saying, the connection between the stories is that in finding out what makes a good Dalek, they take things from humanity, but they twist it, and it's about what in humanity makes good Daleks rather than what in humanity will change them. And that's ultimately the interesting dramatic conflict between the evolution of Sek and the rest of the cult, is that the unchanged Daleks are stuck on their purity, as you say. But it's interesting that they, in both cases, turn to humanity to become more Dalek. It's interesting. And always, of course, the humanity that we see is emphasized even in adversity. You know, obviously, Hooverville, that's a big part of what that represents, is that, and the diversity of humanity as opposed to, you know, the rigidity of the Daleks. But here again, like in Evil, can those things meet and make a better Dalek? But a better Dalek for who? It's of course for them, never for never for us. We won't meet a friendly Dalek for a long time, I think.
We've got Weird Science again, you know.
Yes.
It doesn't really all add up.
I think I had I had much bigger issues with this the first time I saw it, the genetics and the gamma rays and all of that. But I think maybe it's just 15 years of exposure to Marvel movies and the Hulk and and subsequent genetic shenanigans on behalf of the part of the Daleks in laser stories and so on. It doesn't feel like it's quite so grating now. But one thing I remember that niggled at me at the time was the fact that the gamma ray thing and the lightning storm going on, and I was thinking, hey, there's gamma rays from the sun, supposedly, and where's this? But science fans, and this was like 10 years ago, so well after, there's some research that solar activity can indeed trigger lightning on Earth. Has been, yes, apparently, like particles from the solar wind or solar, coronal mass ejections can help trigger lightning storms and things.
Sure. This sort of similar imagery, I think, in this to the Idiot's Lantern.
Yes.
The doctor climbing the antenna again and so on.
Yes, there is. That was slightly disappointing. Because it's very soon after the Idiot's Lantern, really, that they reuse that device. In its defence, it does play into who's the top of the tree, quite literally, holding the power. And I'm prepared to forgive it on that basis. But it's a very similar position for the Tenth Doctor to find himself in.
Yeah. Oh, if we want to do the Doctor, it suddenly come back to me, of course, how I justified it to myself at the time. But if we want to do the sort of Doctor Who science hand-wavy thing, we have actually had the fact that we got these big things of Dalekanium, the shell, bits of shell casing strapped up there as to act as a receiver for this gamma radiation. And in Dalek, we've already seen that Dalek casings have some form of link that can help with genetic restoration and stuff of
a
Dalek. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they can, the fact that they then can do weird genetic things to the waiting, well, they're not cadavers, are they? But they're, people waiting to become Robomen / human Daleks. Maybe it's not so bad after all, or not such a ass pull as Paul would say if he was here.
There's puzzles in this, I guess, like Evil. There's, you know, there's the initial kind of the Doctor sees a thing in the newspaper and wants to follow it up. There's Martha gets the psychic paper and has from the Doctor and has to work out what was he trying to tell me how to do. It's not a manufactured puzzle in the same way that the Waterfield scenario is, but there's still that kind of we've got to solve some problems to reach the next stage of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I really like Martha as a character, and I really like the way it's acted, and I think that contributes to me feeling Series 3 is one of the better New Who type series. And despite the Doctor's utter indifference to her and begrudging companionship, she does okay with a very small amount of material, really. As you say, she's given the psychic paper to get herself into the Empire State Building and start to impact and affect an ending to this situation. She is the person who solves the spot the difference competition on the elevation plans for the buildings.
Yes.
She is the one thrust into questioning the Daleks about what's going on just ahead of the cliffhanger at the end of Daleks in Manhattan. And at the end of all of this tragedy, she is at least trying to fight the mood at the end with the Doctor by talking about the Laszlo Tallulah situation. And, you know, she comes out of the line, I think, there's someone for everyone, which the Doctor huffs about and goes into the TARDIS. But I like her contribution in this episode. It feels natural. It feels appropriate for somebody who has those skills and those characteristics.
Right.
And it just reinforced what I have in my mind, which is Martha was a really good companion.
Yeah, there's a lovely scene that she has with Tallulah where they're sort of talking through their various miseries. I don't know whether, I mean, is it still okay in 2024 to talk about a love of musical theatre? Is that a little bit, you know, I mean, we kind of know what she's talking about, but is that a bit much?
It's possibly period. I don't know what the terminology was back then, but it's also sort of universal.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a bit of a broad stroke there, but it is a common association, a common stereotype.
Yeah, indeed.
I enjoy it, you know.
Right.
I, according to the story, I'm also a lover of musical theater, and so that sort of terminology does make me laugh. It doesn't offend me. It does make me laugh, you know, because, well, we laugh because it's true enough of the time, and it's a benign, characterization. I would say for me personally.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, it's funny that's the reason that Tallulah comes up with.
I mean, the Doctor is a bit of a jerk, isn't he, in this story, really, most of the time.
One might argue that he's a jerk throughout Series 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the storyline of Martha being ultimately so frustrating for her, you know, this isn't, you know, the only time where the Doctor's just kind of like, oh, yeah, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a hard road for Martha to have to travel.
A lot of the time, Doctor Who, you want contrasts in those transitions, whether that's a contrast from Doctor to Doctor or a contrast from companion to companion. So some of the things that could often cross the line in Series 2, where the Doctor and Rose were finding everything a really good laugh, when actually for people involved in those stories, you know, they were in real peril and their world was falling apart. And that kind of rubbed me up a little. We have the contrast in Series 3 where the Doctor is on a monumental sulk as a consequence of the separation from Rose. And Martha is just so absolutely trying to squeeze the joy out of what's an amazing experience for her. The experience that, as viewers, we all want. which is to be able to get in that TARDIS and experience all these wonderful things. You know, and she gets moments in this story, the whole scene where she ruins the stage performance trying to get to Laszlo on the other side of the stage. Fantastic. Made me smile. It made me enjoy the scene even more. It was well acted, but more importantly, it was Martha getting that experience on stage with Shakespeare 1 week, ruining a Broadway performance from the 1930s the next week.
And
I guess, I mean, the human Daleks, the army that they create, they've got, what, machine gun Dalek guns because it's sort of mobsters from the 1920s, you know. That, I mean, and that's stylistically what they are. I mean, does it kind of hold up in terms of why do they get a gun that's better than the one that the Daleks have got, if that's what it is?
Is it? Does it seem to be better?
It just seemed it was the same.
Doesn't it have that kind of repeating fire thing? Does it not work like a machine gun? Don't know.
I don't know. I forget. At this point, are Daleks firing beams, or are they like what would you call it? Like the individual shots of like plasma or whatever you'd call that, like they did in Remembrance or something.
No, it's just beams. They're doing now. I think it's beams. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So.
Maybe you're right. Maybe a beam is more powerful, and little bursts of whatever that it is that they've got is less.
But no, it takes quite a lot of shots to take out the, because there's, you know, the fact there's about a dozen of them training their fire on on the Daleks, so it takes quite a lot of shots to penetrate the galaxy and blow them up.
Okay,
but the human Daleks are done in by the very same question as in Eve.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, I know.
They really
that.
Make a point of that. And they get kind of stuck on it in a way a Dalek would, so it's somewhat satisfying in that way. I think.
Yeah, at that point, though, all those armed individuals have the Doctor factor in them.
That's true.
Transferred from the lightning rod scene.
Yes. Yeah.
A few minutes earlier, and this brings me to a curiosity of both stories where. That they talk about the Daleks never being able to overcome humanity. And my sneaking feeling that every time we see the Daleks attempt to take over humanity being thwarted, it's the Doctor, which is the X factor in turning the tables. And yes, we see lots of human beings contributing in hugely brave acts to help repel the Daleks, but the consistent factor between all of them is the presence of the Doctor and the know-how and the ingenuity and sometimes the science that the Doctor brings with him into this situation. And both these stories are no exception to that.
In light of which, the Doctor's somewhat kamikaze twice in this story. He attempts to to apparently sacrifice himself.
Yes. Yeah. He gets two big scenes to do that.
And just by standing in front of a Dalek gun, seemingly with no particular plan, and twice he gets saved by Dalek sex intervention, which I don't think he could have predicted. Feels a bit foolhardy, and I can understand his character-wise if the fact he's discovered that the Daleks have survived yet again, after all he sort of went through, particularly if he's feeling mopey about Rose, the stuff that he went through in order to seal off the universe and get rid of them last time. I suppose from a character point of view, it makes some sense. But the fact it repeats twice it happens at Hooverville and the theatre is grates with me a little bit. Because he ought to look after himself a bit more.
Yes.
Get a good meal inside him as well. Skinny. Skinny man.
Going to move on to just the two grim scenes, really grim scenes in this story for me. There is the shootout in the theatre at the end, and the fact that there is no saving element for those men who've been taken over by the Daleks and spliced Frankenstein's style into doing somebody's bidding. And it's a real contrast to the earlier scenes in the theatre, which are full of this musical theatre wonder and joy that you see a couple of times in the episode. But the one that really gets to me is the scene in Hooverville where the Daleks come in to confront the Doctor and where Solomon dies. So in 2007, maybe that felt sufficiently a fantasy element. It's set in the 1930s. A long time ago when things were really, really grim. And, you know, here are the Daleks being terrible. To the 2024 lens, as we were alluding to earlier, there are a lot of people in the world at the moment displaced into temporary housing where drones have suddenly become a mechanism of targeting individuals rather than land masses, buildings, whatever. And it really made me think, oh, here we have something which is principally escapism, principally to provide us with enjoyment. And here is some sad foretelling that only, 17 years on, our wonderful little children's programme is showing scenes that will soon be commonplace, perhaps, on our news screens. And, you know, it means that the story holds up as being an important story in terms of what it is showing, but important for some really horrible reasons. There you go. Follow that.
I listened with interest the Murray Gold music. There's that that very choral music, which I call Carmina Dalekiana, which is like this big, you know, choral chanting.
Yes.
And I don't know if they're probably saying words or syllables at least. I didn't investigate further. But he knows how to make a big sound, does Murray Gold. And it's pretty effective there.
I think that's at the end of episode one, isn't it? It's the music that brings us to the cliffhanger.
I believe so, yeah.
And I just assumed they were chanting Dalek lyrically.
They may be. I don't remember. I have a memory in the back of my mind that maybe this is somewhere on a confidential episode or maybe some behind-the-scenes video. I don't honestly remember, but I thought maybe something was being chanted. I think it's in Evolution, too. I think it comes back with... when is it? Maybe the attack on... Is the attack on Hooverville in Manhattan or is it in Evolution? I've forgotten now.
Evolution, I think.
Okay. I think it might have happened around there, but...
Yes, because that's where the Doctor escapes to, having played Happy Days Are Here Again.
Yeah.
Correct. Yes. That's it. That's right.
And on the subject of music, when Happy Days Are Here Again plays out, that choice of music just feels tragic. Happy Days Are Not Here Again for the Doctor. Happy Days Are Not Here Again for anybody in this episode. I'm thinking of is First We Take Manhattan as my song choice for the predicament that everybody is in at that point in time. But it's a lovely juxtaposition between a song that means a symbol of hope in a situation where there is none.
For sure. And it's, if my memory is correct, that's exactly how it was used in 1930. It was a new song. It was a Depression era song, which is just so blindingly positive in just trying to, you know, keep people's spirits up. That's really all it was. I don't remember if it was in a show or if it was just a pop song, but it's amazing how they were able to use it in the exact same way here in a very different way. But the idea of the irony is the same.
Yeah. It was a really, really good moment in the episode.
Yes.
Yeah, so just doing some searching as you're talking about it, it appears to have been written as a song in 1929, appeared in a film in 1930, and then was used by Franklin Roosevelt as part of his election campaign in 1932.
Right, it became a Democratic anthem for many years, Democratic Party anthem.
Interesting. So this has been a really good conversation. and we've said lots of positive things about this story. This is not the perceived wisdom of our fellow Doctor Who magazine readers. In fact, succession of polls, it scrapes at the bottom of the 10th Doctor stories. And there are loads of great 10th Doctor stories. But I feel it's a disservice to this story, which has a story to tell, has a tone to set. It might be a tone that's uncomfortable, in an era that's uncomfortable, and putting forward a point of view which is uncomfortable. But I think it does it in a pretty uncompromising way. And when I was watching it, you know, a couple of days ago, made for compelling viewing.
I agree. I have just, you know, the memory from, 15, 16 years ago now of having seen it. And actually, I wanted to ask you, because you might be, you all must much more knowledgeable about this than I would have been cognizant of at the time. Can you describe to me what exactly the nature of the criticism was of the story without indulging in just blatant meanness, which I'm sure there was? Can you describe to me what was the issue that people had? Do you recall?
I think people found it a bit silly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the pigs, perhaps.
Which can never happen in Doctor Who.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And the plot, I suppose, you know, it's not... As we've described, the richness of the plot is more in the sort of human and dilemmas that they encounter rather than, you know, a really clever piece of plotting. But then, having said all of that, I can't, you know, I wouldn't say that, you know, so yes, later in Series 3, you've got Blink and you've got Utopia and you've got the human nature, I suppose, Family of Blood. So you've got stories later in that season that are perhaps more brilliant, but yeah, it feels like it just hasn't hit for some reason, and I think that maybe that kind of people have just superficial.
Well, I wonder, as you were talking about it, Richard, I started to think about, knowing what I know about Doctor Who fandom, it started to occur to me that the criticism probably has to do with the characterization of the Dalek, the human Dalek itself, and that, you know, breaking of people's canon or headcanon about what the Daleks are and what they are supposed to be. In a way, this was a Dalek taboo that had been broken. Perhaps that's just a supposition. I don't know.
Well, I think, and there was definitely a lot of ire directed towards Dalek sec for both the design and, I think the concept. And, when poor Helen Rayner absolutely seemed to get it in the neck. I'm sure there was a fair dose of misogyny in there.
Oh. Yeah.
The fact that,
Yeah.
This was A, a woman writing, B, possibly the fact that she had been the script editor, and so it's seen as jobs to the girls. But she was the first woman to write a script for the revival, wasn't she?
New Who, right.
There haven't been many.
Yeah, and I just think that I don't quite understand when I don't. I remember people, supposedly the funniest line in terms of the worst line in Doctor Who ever was the Dalek saying the pig slaves have it, about the genetic fluid, or something, and that was, for some reason, it was a meme that this was like the absolute worst moment in Doctor Who ever, and the most hilariously bad thing that had ever been put on screen, and it just went past me, and I thought, oh, that was that line. There's nothing particularly, it doesn't stand out. There's nothing particularly weird. I mean, okay, the pig slaves are a weird and somewhat unsettling idea, but I think they're well executed, personally.
There's an unattractive thing in human nature, which is that there's a good part of it, which is that we want to listen to each other and kind of, whatever. But there's the unattractive side is that everybody piles on. There's this sense of, oh, okay, we're going to pan this one, are we? Right, okay, well, let's get on with it then. And I think perhaps there was that kind of, there was just a, bit of silliness, bit of misogyny, and perhaps just a sort of, oh, we're going to pile on this one, are we? Okay, well.
Yeah.
I think there was possibly a bit of, people having a go at the... I was looking at the wiki page and so on about reception and so on, and the only negative review they actually quote there particularly was someone writing for IGN by the magnificent name of Travis Fickett, who certainly, pardon me, but he sounds American, and possibly had a bit of the same thing. He allegedly saw Tallulah as an offensive stereotype, and the American, so annoyance at the depiction of the Americans within it. But then it's a broad story. But I think there may have been, and that may have been defensive. Let's get in there and have a go at it on the part of British fans as well. Like, let's take the piss out of it rather than. Yeah, but I don't know. I can never quite.
Not that I want to get bogged down in it, but I was sort of curious as to, because having said that, I think it stands up quite well. And we've already talked about how it has transcended when it was made. And now we see different things in it.
Yeah.
The things that weren't intended to be there, but our recent history has changed our perspective on some of the things that happened in the story. And I think it comes off, for me, it came off very well.
Mm. I still feel like there's, it still feels like the odd one out in series three, that almost every other thing, every other story there is snapping bits into places. And it's,
true. If it's not, if actually, for arcs,
if it's not laying in, if it's not laying in plot, then it's, it's thematically, it's got thematic resonances with what's going to play out at the end and so on. But and there's stuff in there about that as well, with genetics and so on, that you could argue there's little echoes or foreshadowings and things. But yeah, perhaps it suffers from that thing of being, it's a filler, possibly a filler story because it doesn't contribute to the arc. And it spends two episodes not contributing to the arc. And other stories that are far more egregiously filler-ish.
Well, we've got Attack of the CGI next week, haven't
exactly,
we?
Exactly, yes, yeah. But then I sort of watched the Coming Soon trailer for that, and my instant thoughts with that were, oh, that's the one that has the phone call about, the Mr. Saxon references.
And right, okay.
And it's got, a couple of what... Is there that, and there's 42 coming up as well, isn't there?
Yes,
Those are the next two before we sort of hit the back end. Mm. But instantly I started thinking, okay, and you got the last shot of that Coming Soon trailer, there's the ring from the Lazarus Experiment, the logo from the...
Right.
The ring from... Yeah, the Master's Ring emblem is on the back wall, and so you kind of think, okay, oh, there's a little bit of arc building stuff, so maybe you kind of give them a pass on reflection for that. But no, it's, I don't know, it's just a massive, massive and unpleasant pile-on, really.
It's an unusual season where the Daleks are not necessarily the A-list.
Yeah.
I think that's the key thing. You get to the latter half of season three, you've got Human Nature and Family of Blood, rightly universally liked. Blink, however atypical it is, held up as one of the greatest episodes ever. And then you're into the Master Trilogy to end the season. So in essence, it's an odd billing for the Daleks in a season of episodes. But I don't think fundamentally, I wouldn't like to think that would be driving people disliking the story.
No,
but I tend to also agree it's more about the depiction of half human, half Dalek.
Well, it being a sort of certainly darkly comedic Dalek story, and people don't tend to like, fandom doesn't tend to like comedy Dalek stories.
No, which brings us back to the three Daleks.
The chase,
It also brings us back to the three Daleks playing with the Second Doctor in either of the Daleks.
That gets a buzz. Yeah.
What would popular wisdom say about them playing trains and being dizzy? Anyway, so for me, for my money, it's a better story than its polling.
Mm.
I just generally found it grim, but compelling watching.
Mm.
Any other thoughts before we limp to the the end of this?
Do we need to go through connections? Because I think we've pretty picked out most of them anyway, haven't we?
Kind of have. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, if you've got any other ones, fine. But yes, I feel like we've kind of addressed that en route, really, haven't we?
Yeah. We've done all the ones I noticed.
The loved one or lover that must be saved from Dalek control is a note I made.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Watch out if you're the Dalek's henchman, but, you know, we've kind of said that, really.
Mm. Yeah.
Quite. We were just talking about what gets the ire of Doctor Who fandom. I know if one of my many failings is that I'm pedantic about the Daleks. And this is another one of those stories where the Daleks' eye stalks wobble when they speak.
Right.
Oh, it kills me. It's a problem that's gone all the way back to Dalek Invasion of Earth. And it's, again, a very small, petty point. But that is an example of one of the things that a fan like me might zero in on and be like, oh, this is just the worst thing ever, when it isn't. But I know that that's always something that's bothered me. If they've already got flashing lights, why do they need to wobble?
Mm.
And it just looks silly.
Mm.
But I find the interactions between the Daleks, I think I find that more interesting than other people. Some people find Dalek conversation boring and stuff like that. I find them intensely watchable and very interesting creatures, you know, especially when they kind of move out of their normal behavior, whether they're extremely cunning or they're suddenly, you know, pretending that they're going to help humans or mellow themselves, as Dalek sex seems to portray that they're going to do. I've always found such great dramatic interest in the Daleks, perhaps more than others. So I will forgive them a lot. Not that there's anything to forgive in here, but except stop wobbling their eye stalks.
Yeah, I think for me, with the Daleks, I find them less interesting when they're just being gratuitously evil. But when they're being cunning, when there's a sort of a plan that they're trying to work out, when, you know, when there's a deeper kind of meaning to what they're trying to achieve, as in both of these stories, they're more interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Excellent. And I think the fact that we've picked up so many common themes that weren't just the Daleks are in it is a credit to Jess, you pairing these two stories for us.
Yes.
That DNA between evil and Daleks and Daleks of Manhattan is clearly there.
Well, I'm glad it was 5 hours well spent for all of us.
Great. Okay, well, look, thanks for that discussion. Thanks to listeners for listening to our podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode of Something Who, then, you know, please subscribe, rate and review our podcast, because that helps us to find a wider audience. And whilst, look, I mean, it's not, we're not doing it for the glory, but, you know, given that we've invested our time and our enthusiasm, it's great that, you know, more people would listen to it.
Mm.
And there's loads more episodes for you to listen to if you've enjoyed this one. So check out our feed, please. If you like Something Who, please tell your friends, your family, your colleagues, your neighbours, and maybe even your local antiques dealer. You know, they may not be across all of the Doctor Who podcasts with all that travelling back to Victorian era to get their stock. But if you hate us, then please don't tell us all. We're aiming to make Something Who recordings about once a month, but it's just a fun thing we do in our spare time, so please be patient with us if it takes a bit longer. But we hope to be back soon with more thoughts on Doctor Who across the decades. But for now, Rick, Jess, Giles, thanks for your time and to your company.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Cheerio. It's been described as the most diffident ending of a podcast in fandom. But there we go.
Lovely.
I'm stopping now.
I didn't make a gamma radiation joke in the end.
Yeah.
Well, it's not too late. Gamma radiation.
I was going to point out that Dalek Sek was just the starters of the new human Dalek race. You know, he was the hors d'oeuvre, which must be obeyed without question, to quote Fawlty Towers, but I decided not to bother. Here's a clip from my other podcast. Hello and welcome to If It's Hurting, It's Not Working, our podcast all about work, how we work, why we work, and what makes a great job. This time, we're going to discuss a fascinating topic, artificial intelligence and its impact on our lives and careers. Hi, Em, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Hi there, nice to be back. It's been a while.
And also joining us is our other co-host, Nicola. How are you doing?
Yes, very well, thank you.
And our guest tonight is someone that we've all worked with and yet somehow has never appeared on this podcast before. It's Viv Leinster.
I'm a people, culture and transformation leader. I've worked in a variety of sectors, not least our previous employer. It seems that I had to leave in order to get invited to this podcast, so I'm delighted to be here.
I think it's quite funny in a way that people think of AI as a recent development, because I first became aware of the subject back in the late 80s when I was studying engineering at Cambridge. So if we fast forward 35 years, and what's really changed things lately is generative AI, and in particular tools like ChatGPT.
What's changed from 35 years ago is the rate of change. So it's the accelerated nature now, I think, of what we are seeing and what AI is capable of. And there's a positive or a dark side and a light side, I think, to AI. And as a co-pilot, you know, to the work that we do, it can be great. If it's doing the jobs that we hate doing, then it's great. But if it's taking over the jobs or the tasks that we love doing, then suddenly it feels a little bit different.
Em, you got thoughts about AI and whether it's coming after your job?
I don't think it's coming after my job, because you can never take away the emotional intelligence, right? AI is not going to be able to do that side of my job. It's got lots of good uses, particularly for myself with dyslexia. I find the minute-taking functionality fantastic. That's something that takes up a lot of time.
Sort of on first impressions, it's incredibly powerful and useful in aspects of the workplace, but I don't think it would be able to take over my job holistically. Are you with us now, Emily?
We do sign language if necessary. I think I know what that means.
Yeah. International sign language.
Yeah.